Please be seated. Well, I'm delighted to be in Houston with my colleagues, Judge King and Judge Wilson, and I want to thank all the attorneys in these three cases for being so resilient. We were supposed to see you a couple months ago, and I hope you weren't already in New Orleans for that. And you're very generous to have adjusted your plans and come all the way to Houston. We're going to hear three cases today. The first one is 2050112, United States of America versus Lara. Is it Mr. Peralta?
That's correct, Your Honor.
You can begin.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Peralta, and I've been appointed under the Criminal Justice Act to represent appellant Melissa Janet Lara. Over the years, this court has repeatedly admonished the government against the improper use of profiling evidence in drug smuggling cases. And this case presents a particularly egregious example of that. The government's final witness at this trial was a Border Patrol agent by the name of Huerta, who testified that he had interviewed hundreds of drug smugglers and had read reports involving hundreds of others. And based on that, in his expert opinion, quote, usually they know they're transporting narcotics. And this court in United States versus Gutierrez-Farias found an abuse of discretion involving virtually identical testimony. As a matter of fact, the testimony in that case was not nearly as bad as...
In that case, had the district court actually instructed the government not to do that?
I don't know if that involved a motion in limine.
So, but this case did.
This case did, Your Honor. And of course, that goes to the standard of review in this case, which we strongly believe will be under an abuse of discretion.
In my mind, that's the biggest difficulty here. I don't know if it was tactical or just ineffective, but without renewing the objection, you probably have thoughts on that. Yeah. Whether you were trial counsel or not. It could easily be strategic advantage to not object if you think that the statement made by the expert actually might benefit you. And one of the two sisters did later capitalize on some of his scienter remarks.
Right. Of course, litigants in the heat of trial have to deal with the evidence that comes out, whether it was contrary to a pretrial ruling or not. They have to deal with the facts on the ground.
But standard review often focuses on the district court's opportunity to correct something. And so... The district court wouldn't necessarily object on its own initiative.
I would direct the court to two, I think, what are insurmountable hurdles for the government in their attempt to get to plain error review. One is the plain language of Rule 103B that clearly states that if a defendant gets a pretrial ruling or a ruling, definitive ruling, either before trial or at trial, then they do not need to renew an objection at trial.
Why am I remembering, and it's been a while, that the advisory committee notes virtually suggest the opposite, that contemporaneous objection means just that. Am I not right that the advisory committee notes would suggest if you win below and then it appears that the opposing side is breaching that restriction, the motion in limine, you've got to, there's nothing in the advisory committee notes that suggests you have to object again?
I think, and I pointed this out in my reply brief, I think the case law in this area is sort of all over the map. There are cases where a government motion in limine is denied, is granted. Is a contemporaneous trial objection required? There are situations where a defense motion in limine is either denied or granted. And in either of those circumstances, is a contemporaneous objection required? But what I would point the court to is the most recent case law from this court, a case out of 2017, Lucas versus State, and I have the cite to that.
Did you put it in your brief?
It's not in the brief, Judge.
Okay, that's not going to help your opposing counsel respond to it. But
I understand.
Because they don't know the case and we haven't read it, I'm just going to ask you, when I read the direct, the cross, the redirect, the recross, this witness ultimately was at some point did acknowledge that he had not had no firsthand information about the, your client.
That's correct, Your Honor. He was brought in as an expert witness.
So if it's plain error, that's going to be, and then they don't, the government doesn't rely on it in closing. If it ends up being plain error, it's a difficult argument to make. So it doesn't.
Yeah, plain error is a very high hurdle.
Yeah.
Litigants are rarely successful on plain error review.
But don't all these cross currents that Judge Higginson's noted further suggest that, you know, the interpretation of the rule in the advisory committee notes, to his point, would suggest that the law at least ought to be, or it maybe is, that you object at the time. In other words, you put it before the district court so the district court has the opportunity to cure.
That would be the best practice. Had I been trial counsel, I certainly would have objected, and I would have made as much of an issue before the jury as I could.
I mean, that's what the Fonseca case, I guess, in the Tenth Circuit says.
Yes.
But talk a little bit more about our law. I mean, do we go both ways, sort of all across the map, or have we just not answered this question yet directly?
I think you have to distinguish the circumstances in which the issue arises. Was it a government motion in limine, or was it a defense motion? Because the case law conflates those two situations.
Well, or is the right inquiry, was it a granted motion in limine, or was it a denied motion in limine?
Well, and to get to your, that is another factor, obviously. Although Rule 103 just says it has to be a definitive ruling. Of course, if the motion is denied, then the evidence is coming in.
What's the downside to the law? What's the downside to the law if the requirement is you do have to make a contemporaneous? How would that ever?
Well, for one thing, as a former AUSA, I plan my trial strategy on the pretrial evidentiary rulings. I have to. So if the defense counsel does the same thing, if there's a definitive ruling on the record by a district judge on a motion in limine, I should be able to rely on good faith, and I do in this case, that the AUSA informed his witness of what the ruling was and to stay away from those profiling type issues. I assume they did that. They're supposed to.
And it's certainly true. If a district judge is, you're right, if a district judge has said, don't elicit this answer, and you want to get anywhere near it, you should ask to go come up to the bar and ask. None of that happened. It just came out quickly.
Correct? It just came out. The district court did not intercede. And I believe there's a provision of Rule 103, it might be subsection D, that says that the district courts should conduct the trial in such a manner as to prevent inadmissible evidence from coming in. So I don't know if that places a sua sponte obligation.
But lo and behold, the witness then says, well, when they do know it's narcotics in there, they always plead guilty. And then that ends up being advantageous in closing for one of the sisters. So without a further objection, why would the court interject and stop if maybe the defense thinks this witness is helping them?
The court has a prior ruling that it issued.
You know, I guess, Gutierrez Ferris pretty well, correct?
Yes.
Well, there's the footnote at the end that says, well, you don't have to directly attribute it.
Yes,
but,
sir.
But
that's the functional equivalent.
And you think there's no way that this wasn't that?
I think this was definitely a violation of Gutierrez Ferris. And the other thing is the government followed up this statement by asking him. So you're saying that most of these people know that they're carrying some type of narcotic? And the answer was yes. And on the standard of review, Judge, the most recent case law from this court, there are cases directly on point where a defense motion to grant a motion in limine to keep out evidence was violated at trial. Evidence came in. There was no contemporaneous trial objection. And this court held that is sufficient, then no further objection is required.
In which case you referred
that
to?
That was the Lucas case.
Okay. Maybe you should give us the cite then.
Yes, sir. And that review is under abuse of discretion. That would be 2017, 849, F3rd, 638. Your Honor, very quickly, the final issue would be, I would like to discuss would be the impeachment evidence. They called an agent by the name of Leonard to testify solely about a debrief that was had of a co-defendant, Priscilla Ramirez. The government believes that that is impeachment evidence under Rule 613. However, they somehow believe they're not required to satisfy the foundational requirements of 613. There was no confrontation of the witness with this prior statement to give her an opportunity to admit or deny. So I would also bring that to the court.
Well, okay, and your time's up, but I have a question on that because I've thought it was a more difficult area of law than it appears to be in the case law. Ramirez is a co-conspirator cooperating, and then they decide to impeach her with her factual basis, correct?
They did impeach her with the factual basis.
Okay.
But what they did then is because she had softened her position with respect to the knowledge issue.
Right.
They brought in this agent to bring in the evidence of the debrief. So it's two different things. You have a written factual basis.
My question to you is twofold.
Yes, sir.
At trial, was there an objection to that?
No. That is going to be under plain review. Yes, sir.
And then was there a limiting instruction that could only be considered for impeachment, or did it come in as substantive proof?
No, there was no instruction. Limiting instruction stating that it can only be used for impeachment purposes. Right.
Nor was it requested. Okay, that's fine, counsel. I mean, it's a tricky area of law, but that's...
Just one other thing. In closing, the government did say that prior debrief proved, and that's
knowledge.
A direct quote, proved that these defendants knew what they were doing. So it was used as substantive evidence. Thank you.
Mr. Beard?
May it please the court.
Is it Mr. Beard?
It is Beard, okay. Jerry Beard for Mary Ann Laura. We had earlier in the year adopted by way of Rule 28I points 2, 3, and 4 from co-appellants' briefs, and I'm going to stand on those briefs. I'd like to turn the panel's attention, if I can, to some of the inferences that were drawn in the case to establish knowledge.
This whole case was about knowledge.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, it's, in my experience, one of the, perhaps for lack of a better term, purest cases. The prosecutor at the Rule 29 hearing said this is all circumstantial. This is all what it was going to be. And then Mary Ann Lara's attorney, and in fact, Melissa's attorney as well, basically echoed and said, yes, this is a no-knowledge case.
Yeah.
So on appeal... And certainly right now, what I want to focus on are some of those inferences. Because, of course, while it is uphill sledding, and I acknowledge that at the outset, to contest a lot of inferences that are drawn by the jury, that's not to say that they're all rational, and it's not to say that they're all not, that some of them aren't speculative. And I believe, in fact, some of these are speculative. And I start first with the inferences.
Just legally, though, you're not pressing equipoise means reverse. You understand?
I am not.
Okay.
I'm aware of the court's position in Vargas Ocampo. And, in fact, it's Judge Jones writing in that en banc opinion that had said that rationality remains. Yeah. excuse me.
Just to save you time, if it was undisputed that they denied knowing each other, two sisters, why wouldn't right there a jury be able to infer, you know,
well, I think there may be inferences, but the question is how far they draw or how far they go, Judge Higginson, because what's at play here is the inference of knowledge of drugs. We know, for example, that there were questions at the outset, the day before the ill-fated trip to Mexico, that there may have been questions about whether the truck was stolen, but a stolen truck does not equate necessarily to knowledge of drug smuggling. Importation and possible distribution. The government began at trial with trying to point out that, well, the truck had very, very poor suspension. It was shaky when it was driving. And that's true, but I don't know that that necessarily gets you to criminality. And then if it got you to criminality...
But if there is, as you suggest, an inference, an open inference as to consciousness of guilt, why isn't that sufficient?
That may go to... And I will reach that shortly.
Okay.
The the inference that might be taken from the discussions that took place the day before might go possibly to conspiracy. I don't know that they go necessarily to the substantive counts, because as this particular trial points out, there was another individual who was involved in this who had been told, yes, you're going to be bringing a truck full of, not full of drugs, actually a kilo of cocaine. You're going to be bringing one back, a vehicle back that had it. That's not the case here. These sisters were not told any such thing. At most, Mary Ann Lara did ask the question and was repeatedly advised, this is not a truck that's loaded. This is not a truck that was stolen. This is a truck that's going to be used for work.
But this is what the jury heard.
It is, in fact, what the jury heard. And there were multiple counts. And this may be a situation where inferences will reach some of the counts, but perhaps not others. And this is why initially I was wanting to point out that inferences that went to the knowledge of the drugs, the suspension, if you will, I don't think that a truck that's not drivable or is shakable necessarily implies or reaches knowledge that there are drugs hidden in the tires. And I would suggest what an inference to be drawn there is that you have suspension problems.
How many objects of the conspiracy were there? Wasn't it just a drug 841 conspiracy?
No, there was also importation.
But how could you have sufficient scienter for conspiracy and not for a substantive count?
Because you might, it's conceivable, and I'm not suggesting, I can't look inside everyone's minds, but you might have an agreement to facilitate a criminal activity, but not necessarily know that it was taking place right then in terms of the substantive possession. Likewise, the fact that when the Lara sisters and Priscilla Ramirez were removed from their cars during secondary inspection and initially may not have known each other, the fact that people are or are not talking, it could be used either way. If they had been talking to each other, I have no doubt that we would be told that this was evidence that they, in fact, were involved with something. The fact that they aren't talking to each other is now evidence that they were involved in something. It tends to go both ways, and I'm not sure that that's particularly rational, if you will. Finally, as to the substantive counts, the improper expert testimony that you had just heard about, the expert specifically said, well, the drug traffickers, the major players, make sure that the mules don't know quantity, value, or location. Your Honor?
No, go ahead.
Excuse me. At the same time, the government is saying, well, the fact that this is worth $7.4 million also can be used to establish the knowledge element.
Well, it is strange for the government's expert to say they don't know knowledge in amount, and then at sentencing, I assume both your clients were their sentence corresponded to amount.
Yes.
This
is true, and I see that my time has run out. If I can just point out one interesting facet about this case. With the other individual that was pleading, she had been told, well, you're going to have a kilo of cocaine. That's actually what she knew in advance. At least that's what she'd been told. And yet, of course, at sentencing, she was actually sentenced for 30-plus kilograms of methamphetamine. So my point simply being that the valuation seems to go all over the place. If you do know what's coming, you can still be what's being smuggled. You can still be sentenced on the basis of something else. If you don't know what the location, value, or type drug is, you can still be sentenced later. That, to me, is illustrative of an inference that is irrational.
Yeah.
My time is...
Thank you. I think you have rebuttal, however you divided it. Is it Ms. Berenger?
Good morning, Your Honor. Elizabeth Berenger from the Western District of Texas on behalf of the United States. I'm going to first address the expert issue. I think this court can affirm on plain air review on this one. And first, just addressing the questions about the standard of review, it seems the court's aware of the 28J I filed in this case, and the advisory committee notes clearly contemplate the situation in this case where the error would be the violation of the rule in limine and not necessarily the rule. So we also have a Fifth Circuit case that I've cited in there.
But I guess it's important for me to not immediately go behind the standard of review because you weren't trial counsel, but it looks like this assistant U.S. attorney not only has an exact map on to what we warned against, and you may try to distinguish Gutierrez-Fierez, but it looks to me not only on point, but it's much more compounded here because here the district court said don't elicit from a witness that mules know there's narcotics. And when a prosecutor's told don't do that, and then what's the transcript? The question is, okay, based on your interviews, generally, how much did these load drivers know about this? Well, they usually know they're transporting narcotics. That's exactly what the assistant U.S. attorney was told not to do.
Well, a few responses to that. My reading of this is that it's a little unelicited by the agent. Not that the prosecutor...
It's a little what?
It's unelicited, the response. I mean, he's asking about...
No, I know, but opposing counsel's right. If you get a motion in limine instruction, you tell your... You can't then say, oh, I was... not expecting that answer.
Sure. And I don't want to press too hard. It's very hard to distinguish Gutierrez-Fierez. It's hard, but Portillo may... Portillo
okay, but I agree with you, then I appreciate that. Then why does the government do it? Because we keep saying harmless or not plain error. You couldn't have a clearer warning from our court, and then you couldn't have a clearer warning from a district judge, and yet the witness does it in a case that's all about knowledge. An expert says they know. How can you cross-examine an expert?
Well, the responsibility in that case is for the defense to object. But instead of objecting, as you said, the defense capitalized on this.
No. The cat's out of the bag. How can the defense object as you just agreed? The witnesses just said it. Oh, Your Honor, strike that. Instruct the jury to disregard that my clients knew.
Well, the defense actually did something more effective in this case, is that they elicited an opinion saying that load drivers don't always have knowledge, which is actually very helpful for their defense. Marianne Laura on 649-52, and I would actually say that she waived the objection, Marianne Laura. She asked these highly effective questions about, but sometimes they don't know. And the agent admits, yes, sometimes they don't know. And that's very helpful to defense, more helpful even probably than an objection would have been. So here we have this sort of tactical decision by Marianne Laura, and Melissa doesn't move to sever, to take this tactic instead of objecting to get something even more beneficial out of that.
I don't read it, counsel, and I mean, maybe the government thinks it can come out of this line. The redirect examination from the same assistant U.S. attorney, it's Mr. Harrell or Mrs. Harrell?
Mr.
Mr. Harrell, on redirect, he goes right back to the same direction with his expert, right? As far as you know, do they lie about what they think they're bringing in? They always lie. So they're going right back to the state of mind of these defendants. So now we force the defense counsel on recross. And what do? They begin to do the only thing you could do, which is, wait a minute, expert, you didn't meet my witnesses, my clients. And the assistant U.S. attorney objects and says this expert has no personal knowledge.
Judge Higginson, I have to disagree with you about how effective a curative instruction would have been from the court. If you have a district court judge instructing the jury needs to disregard this question. This is improper for the witness to testify. And I believe, based on the pretrial conference, Judge Moses would have done that. The jury is presumed to follow that instruction.
But you remember when this assistant U.S. attorney objects on recross for the defense trying to correct. And you remember how this all finished? It forced the district judge... At the very end, the district judge has to intercede and say, well, can I clear up something? Expert, you didn't know anything about the Laras, did you? Remember that?
That is helpful for the defense as well, to remind the jury that he has no knowledge of these particular cases. And it also instructed the jury at the end that it could give whatever weight to the expert that it wanted to. But even moving on from there, if we have third prong, like I agree, this was a mistake. Like, it's a mistake. And I think Portillo makes it confusing about whether it's clear and obvious error. I think that case is actually very similar. How much knowledge does this role in the organization have? And the court distinguishes.
You mean switching to plain error review?
No, I'm saying that even for second prong, Portillo throws some confusion into the mix as far as second prong.
You're on plain error review, second prong of plain error review.
Whether it's clear and
obvious. So you're assuming that we've decided you do have to object.
I the case law seems clear to me that this is plain error review. But moving on to third...
Tell us how, though, because if it's an abuse of discretion, I think to Judge Higginson's point, our analysis may be very different than assuming plain error. So tell us the state of our law.
I agree. I think that this would be a very tough call under an abuse of discretion standard. But under plain error, you mean you want me to address why it's plain error?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this a little bit with counsel opposite.
Right.
Have we just not answered this question?
Right. I think the court has answered the question, and I think the commentary to the rule answers the question. So Federal Rule 103, the advisory committee notes to the amendment says that provision about renewing objection only applies to losing parties. And if the court changes its initial ruling or if the opposing party violates the terms of the initial ruling, which is what happened in this case, the objection must be made when the evidence is offered to preserve the claim of error for appeal. And they cited a Fifth Circuit decision in United States versus Aviation Underwriters.
Is that post-Mathis?
It's a 2000 amendment. Fonseca.
No, I'm asking, is the case you just cited post-Mathis?
It's post-Mathis. How would that apply, Mathis?
Well, did Mathis even distinguish between a granted or a denied motion to retrial? I don't think so.
I'm not sure Mathis. I'm not sure how Mathis.
In Mathis,
the Supreme Court decision in Mathis about sentencing categorical approach?
Mathis, if you win a pretrial motion, you don't have to object again to preserve your claim on appeal.
That's for losing parties under the rule.
But that's exactly what I'm asking you. In Mathis, did the court distinguish between granting and losing?
I'm not up to speed on Mathis. I'm happy to file a letter after this argument about it. But
I don't think they did.
I'm not aware.
Would it
of the
be
nuances.
Interesting if the Supreme Court didn't distinguish? So it says you do not need to preserve again, Mathis, Supreme Court.
Right, but the error
without
here,
distinguishing between a denied and a granted motion in limine.
The error here is not the expert testimony. It's the government's violation of the pretrial ruling. That would be the objection. Is the defense needs to objection.
Wait, stop there. How could the error possibly not be the expert's testimony? That's the 703 violation.
Right, but according to the commentary, the error is the government violating the rule. I mean, the underlying rule, of course, is the 704.
Gutierrez violation. Didn't have a pretrial instruction. So what you've got here is what I said at the beginning, a compounded error. You have clear Fifth Circuit published instruction not to do something, compounded by a district court saying don't do it, and then the assistant U.S. attorney does it.
I understand the court's concern with this testimony, but I would like to talk about why it's not plain error. First of all, again...
Well, again, just because it's emphatic, because the government can keep doing it, hoping that it gets away with harmlessness or plain error review. So I'm going to say, once again, it's important because you're an appellate chief or you're an appellate counsel. I don't see it as a, quote, mistake. I see it as an error that the government keeps doing. And in a case where knowledge is at play, and we additionally have another issue in this appeal about did they talk about the defendant's silence, it looks to me much more like not a mistake.
I think that's an unfair characterization of the record when you have an unelicited statement. I think this wasn't a mistake at trial. All trials have mistakes, as you know. And the question is who is supposed to alert the court to those mistakes? And it was the defense. Like both defendants were represented by able counsel, experienced counsel, who decided instead of objecting, they were going to exploit that testimony and actually get very favorable testimony out of it.
But counsel, to Judge Higginson's points too, I mean, it seems to me when you characterize this as a separate error, it presupposes, I mean, that almost sounds like the analysis we'd engage in if we wanted to follow Fonseca, the Tenth Circuit, and say that, in fact, this is distinct from the motion in limine ruling from the get-go. What if we see them as the same error? Do we still get to abuse of discretion or, I mean, plain error?
All I can tell you is that the rule contemplates this precise situation.
But what about our case law, though?
Your case law, in the case cited in the government's 28J, the Fifth Circuit has addressed that. And also in the McCormick...
Portillo?
What?
Portillo?
No, in Underwriters, the Underwriters case, Aviation Underwriters. So the court, but of course that was pre-amendment, but it addressed sort of the similar situation. And then the Fonseca, which I felt like is very well reasoned from the 10th Circuit and sort of explaining the nuances of what standard of review applies in a very similar procedural posture. So, I mean, plain error is the time to make the objections for appellate review is at the trial level. And if they thought that this was so damaging and harmful, then they should have alerted the district court, who in all likelihood would have given a cure instruction. But instead, now we're sandbagging on appeal where we failed to preserve our right below, hoping for a better result.
You sort of had me, but now you don't really again, because again, think of the, what can you object when the witness blurts it out? You can't unring that bell.
I mean,
you tell me if you're a defense counsel, what's
your
objection?
I disagree, Your Honor.
What is your objection? What do you say? May we approach?
I would ask for a curative instruction. I say this is a violation of the rule in limine. Okay. This is inappropriate testimony.
You win on that. What is the curative instruction?
The court instructs the jury that this particular witness, not only a 704, but a 702 objection to say, how is this helpful? How is this helpful to the jury? And get that all on the record, that it's not helpful to the jury, that they're the arbiters of these factual issues, that this person is not qualified to
but
make that.
But they just heard a Border Patrol intelligence expert saying the mules know they're narcotics in the car.
I mean, you're assuming that the jury is not going to follow the court's instructions. That's totally contrary to this court's precedent, that the jury would follow those curative instructions.
So the curative instruction is, ladies and gentlemen, disregard what Agent Huerta just
told. Yes, it's inappropriate for him to express that type of opinion. I think I would ask for more than just strike from the record and object. And you know what? I was like trying to think of what the prosecutor could have done in this situation to like fix it. And it took me a while to be like, the answer is it's non-responsive. The only objection for the prosecutor. Otherwise, they highlight this testimony.
True. But you don't then object when later on Reed Cross, the defense counsel is trying to clean it up. That made it look much more opportunistic.
Well, the defense got a lot of helpful information
they
from
did
that
get some stuff
in violation of the rule. I mean, the defense is also violating this rule, asking for mental state, the functional
so
equivalent.
So if
state.
We do get to plain error, which you've been trying hard to get to, commendably, then third and fourth prong, the government doesn't refer at all to Agent Huerta's statement.
They don't, and it's ambivalent testimony. Sometimes they know, sometimes they don't know. And I do want to say that this is not the typical, you know, knowledge was very important at this trial, but this is not the typical port of entry case. This is not just like the defendant was nervous and there were a lot of drugs in the car, which is where we see this sort of case law develop. There was a lot of other evidence of knowledge in this case. We have for the, you know, 5 hours before this, 4 hours before this, testimony from a cooperator about what's going on. We have admissions that the car was not driving correctly. We have the Facebook messages about asking multiple times if the car is clean, telling people to delete texts, the urgency of the arrest, the lies at the port of entry. They recruit someone they've never met to drive the car. Ramirez even asks if the truck is stolen, if there's drugs inside. They attempt to try to intimidate the cooperator, the sheer amount of drugs. So this is.
But it was a case all about knowledge.
It was a case about knowledge, but.
Okay.
But that opinion by the Border Patrol agent didn't really contribute to the case. It wasn't like it rested on that. They didn't need it, the government. And they didn't need it. And we know this because they didn't use it at all in closing argument. Nobody even referred to it. So how important could it have been if the government didn't even refer to it at closing argument?
I'm going to make the point this is a little more difficult for your argument, although it wasn't seized on defense today. I would like you to speak to whether or not the prosecutor commented on the defendant's silence. I'm particularly concerned. I know they pointed to three instances of it, but I'm only concerned about the one at the beginning of defense closing. And tell me if I'm quoting it correctly. Speaking to the jury, I'm assuming it was the same assistant U.S. attorney.
It was a different one. It was the co-counsel.
Interesting. Okay. You have no evidence of any statements from the Laras. No direct statements. What was in their minds? How could that not be drawing to the attention of the jury that they had chosen not to testify?
Well, the answer is context. From the context of the case and the prosecutor's comments, she was inartfully trying to discuss that there's no direct statements of guilt in this case and we have to rely on circumstantial evidence. And how do we get that?
Okay, but the trouble is there again, we've got, just the government made mistakes. Let's forgive them. Would it be okay for them to have said to the jury, you have no testimony from these two defendants? No, clearly not.
No.
Okay.
No.
But so instead it's okay to say you have no direct evidence of any statements from the defendants?
Well, I think she was trying to say that.
Trying to say.
I mean, my interpretation of those comments, I don't think that the jury would have interpreted this as a statement on the defendant's failure to testify more than the absence of direct evidence of knowledge.
You can't say you have no testimony from defendants, but you can say you have not heard any statements from the defendants?
I just want to point out 586 of the record where defense mm-hmm. counsel says pretty much the exact same thing conversely, where they say, what's going on here? What's happening? What is Marianne Lara? What does she have in her mind? I mean, how else do people talk about circumstantial evidence other than, do you want a script for the prosecutor?
Okay, what's your best case that says that a government prosecutor, when the defense have chosen not to say testify, can say to the jury, what's on their minds? We didn't hear any statements from them.
I think in context, that's an unfair characterization.
But I'm quoting, you don't have any statements.
Right, but she says, you have this. This is the evidence that you have. Like, we don't have direct statements. We don't have any direct evidence of them admitting
okay,
knowledge.
I thought that would have to be it. So the wrong thing would have been to say you don't have any direct statements, but it's okay for prosecutors to say you don't have any statements.
I think they're clearly talking about the evidence at the port, that we don't have any direct confessions, but we have a lot of other evidence. I mean, both defendants spoke with the officers here.
I agree. Had the prosecutor said, we don't have any you don't have any tapes of them talking. You don't have any confessions. But if you just start your closing argument, we don't know what's on their minds. We don't have any statements from them. What's the Fifth Circuit case that says that isn't violent?
I mean,
what's your closest case?
There isn't any case saying that is.
No, I'm asking you, what's your closest case allowing prosecutors to say that? Can you think of any from any circuit?
Your Honor, first of all, this is plain error.
So
this was not objected to it. So
I agree
on this, the defendant has a very difficult burden to show that it affects it.
Okay, but now you're slipping to plain error again. I'm asking you for a case that we just need to have prosecutors
understand. Arguments, it's very, I mean, not all prosecutors talk the same way. It's very factually dependent on the context of the case. So I don't have a case right now that says it's okay, but there's no case that says it's not okay. That a prosecutor can comment on the evidence and the fact that there's a jury instruction that says something kind of similar to what the prosecutor is saying about she's in artfully trying to get across that it's not direct knowledge that's important. It's circumstantial evidence of knowledge.
Okay. Any of that direct versus circumstantial would be wonderful. In a case that's all about knowledge, to start your closing argument saying, would have been nice to hear their statements. Don't have those statements. Don't know what's on their mind. Pretty hard for me to think how that isn't commenting on their sounds. You may say, well, it's just the way people speak inartfully, but you haven't given me a case that gets anywhere near that.
I mean, we're talking about whether to reverse a trial based on a sentence that a prosecutor led with to tell the jury what the case is about.
I agree. You may prevail on plain error, but here again, it's really important for prosecutors to know what are the rules. So plain error tends to mean, are we agreeing there's error, maybe even clear error? That would be a strong published Fifth Circuit case for you.
I don't even think this rises to that level.
Does it rise to error?
It could have.
Does it rise to error?
I don't believe so.
Okay, do you have a case?
I mean, I feel like the cases that I cite in my brief talk about the enormous discretion that prosecutors have in sort of commenting on the evidence. The rule is okay. That what the jury has
I'm just going to correct you again. It's not commenting on the evidence. It's commenting on what was in the mind of a defendant who elected not to testify.
Yeah, and we're talking about knowledge, which is based on how do you get into the mind of a defendant? How do you formulate what knowledge is? It's all circumstance. I mean, a prosecutor has a tough job to be able to tell a jury on the absence of any direct evidence what is in the mind of a defendant. I mean, isn't that
before your time question? Elapses when the government decided to cross-examine its own cooperating witness, Ramirez, did that evidence come in substantively or only for impeachment?
I think the intent of that evidence was clearly to come in as impeachment evidence.
Was there a limiting instruction?
There was not a limiting instruction.
Okay, so did the factual basis that came in as to one of the co-conspirators contain a statement about this person had knowledge?
So it's a little convoluted. My time is expiring.
No, go ahead. Okay. I'm asking you a lot of questions.
The problem is that the plea agreement came in as substantive evidence. But mm-hmm. Agent Leonard's statements about what Ramirez said at the meeting, that should have only been a prior inconsistent statement. Right. So I believe all of that evidence, the jury should have been instructed. I think it is error, and it's probably plain error for the court not to have instructed that way, but I don't think the defendants can meet the third prong in this case.
Okay.
So.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Just ask for you to affirm the judgment sentence.
This may be ineffectiveness of counsel. I mean, what if all these are subject to plain error? I mean, opposing counsel is acknowledging there were mistakes, it was inartful, and the last comment was yet again, but each time it looks like defense counsel could have brought this to somebody's attention.
I agree, but of course you know that...
Well, be careful. When you say you agree it's plain error, all three issues?
No, I agree that it was not effective assistance, I don't think. I cringed when I was reading this transcript. Now, there may be strategic tactical reasons for why they acted or did not act in a particular way, but that's not something I can argue on direct appeal because there's no record as to what their
Well, I pressed the government, but if the defense is doing some of this strategically, then opposing counsel's correct that
Yes. I'm just pointing out that I thought about raising ineffective assistance, but I didn't think it was going to go.
Well, it's direct appeal, so that's still there.
So, interestingly, we look at, you have the Border Patrol agent, his testimony, which was error and went improperly to the defendant's state of mind. You have these statements about direct evidence, improperly admitted, that went to the state of mind.
No objection.
Debrief from Priscilla Ramirez that they brought in solely to state that she suspected something.
Yeah, but no objection again.
And therefore that proved that the defendants knew.
Yeah.
So they're all around the central issue. Where is the actual evidence that my client knew what was in the car or that my client entered into any kind of conspiratorial agreement prior to going to Mexico? If you look at my sufficiency...
No, they made a lot of evasive and inconsistent comments.
They did, but Your Honor, I defy this court to read that transcript and figure out who said what about whom. Okay. It is replete with, they said this, they did this, the sisters said that, the sisters did this. Now that raises a very interesting question, is how do you take those ambiguous facts and fit them into the concept of taking the evidence in the light most favorable.
Okay. I didn't give her extra time, so I shouldn't. But thank you all. It's an interesting case. It's been submitted.
Wait, he has 2 minutes.
Oh, I always do that. Shows I don't preside very often.
I don't know that we'll be in fact 2 minutes. We'll find out, but there are a couple of minutes I'd like to miss.
Your Judge Wilson saved you.
Judge Wilson. You had written down, you can't unring a bell. I'm sorry, you had said that. I had written it already. You can't. This is a pure no-knowledge case. Their side said as much. I can't imagine a better case, quite frankly, notwithstanding the lack of contemporaneous objection to, if you will, give teeth to your admonitions.
Well, but counsel, I mean, there are lots of bells that get rung in trial.
Yes.
That you can't unring, but there are things that could have been done on an objection.
This is true.
The curative instruction... some sort of limiting instruction. I mean, there are various things, but we don't have any of that because there was no objection. The objection is the trigger. Whether it unrings the bell or not, it is maybe beside the point.
I suppose my response would be some bells ring louder than others.
They do.
And this is a particularly egregious bell.
How long was the jury out?
I don't know.
Was
I
there
can't
any
recall.
Any jury questions?
No, not that I'm aware, Your Honor. I'd also point out that... certainly not my place to defend the entire defense bar, but I'm always frustrated when I hear the government characterizing issues that occur after the government's mistake to be tactical. Well, yes, as a former military officer, I will tell you there are all sorts of tactical decisions that are made on the battlefield, in the air, in response to changing circumstances. The circumstances that changed here were the circumstances that the government's prosecutors caused, if you will. They solicited the improper testimony. to say that the defense counsel then should be held to some type of critique for the tactical decisions that they were making.
Well, tactical or strategic, I mean, they are different levels, I guess. But doesn't the defense counsel's response and tailoring or adapting as they go, I mean, doesn't that suggest that they could easily have objected? In other words, doesn't this suggest strategy as much as tactics?
No, I don't think it suggests strategy because the law, may I continue?
Yeah.
The law is clear, as Judge Higginson had pointed out, the court repeatedly admonishes not to bring in this type of testimony. That the decisions that defense counsel make are at least initially made in contemplation that the government will follow that rule. It's not remarkable, I don't think.
Okay, thank
then
you.
To question the tactics after they have not followed the rule, I would just respectfully ask that the court tread carefully there, because now you're putting yourselves in the minds of the defense counsel as well. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank
you.
I
would ask that you reverse or alternatively reverse and remand for the reasons discussed.
Okay. Second.